altitude's undefeated.
Crap, rainbow, punch it up, whatever it was in.
Not a huge fan of it,
I don't know where I was going. I looked like I was running and started to talk to someone. I don't know what I was doing.
I tell you what, Matt, we don't get much by you, that's for sure. From you and analysis in your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Colorado Rapids fans. This is Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. It is Wednesday, September 13th, 2023, 2 days after the 22nd anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11th. Never forget. The USMNT got two friendly wins, and fans are still grumpy because, of course, Welcome to Wrexham Season 2 is back. The New England Revolution are about as organized as the French Revolution were, and the Colorado Rapids have some eventful supporter activities coming up this weekend, which we will discuss. Joining me now, the Rob McAleen to my Ryan Reynolds, Rabbi Mark Goodman.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. It's like substance over beauty. You know, like Ryan Reynolds is the sizzle that everybody's excited about, and Rob McElhenney is like the passion. I don't know, man. I mean, maybe it's the other way around, but I'll let it go. It's good to see you, Matt.
I'm the better looking one, Mark, and I've got better hair. And if one of us is dressing up as Deadpool for Halloween, now that we are in spooky season with the pumpkin spice latte back at Starbucks, it would be moi. So that was the reasoning behind it. I meant no disrespect to you. Rob McElhenney is a respected member of the Wrexham soccer community, as respected as you are within the Rapids community.
Oh, that's so sweet. I like the beauty for before age kind of aspect of the Matt to Mark thing, that I'm bald and old and mostly a non-functional, but still running 12-minute miles as I prepare for whatever 10K comes, you know, in the fall here in Pittsburgh. I'm in the bell jar here, folks. You know, September 11th is an important milestone for America and a somber day. And then the Jewish people almost immediately following that go right into our holy season. We have the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah, followed by the Jewish Day of Penitence, Yom Kippur, followed immediately by us dwelling in a hut for 8 days, which I festoon with soccer scarves. That should be a good old time, but it also means I'm overworked, overexhausted, overstressed, overanxious, thank God, though, for bourbon, because if it weren't for this old-fashioned in my right hand, I don't know how I'd do. Let's get to the football and the other bantery-type things, Matt. Tell us what's going on in the world that you think is worthy of your red-headed analysis.
Let's start, Mark, chronologically with the week that we've had going back since last we podcasted. September 6th, we had the second Portsmouth press conference that was live streamed on all of the social media platforms by the club. I released a separate 20-minute kind of reaction audio podcast to that, Mark. So I've mostly said my piece. It's been 8 days. Most fans listening to this probably watched it live or have watched it at least once back since then. And I think most fans, Mark, are astute enough to draw their own conclusions about how that went and what it says about the club. But I'll yield the floor to you, Herr Congressman from Pittsburgh, to give your take on it and anything you want to say.
The conference was hard to watch for any media member who's been to lots of Portsmouth press conferences. Porik is a really good, we've talked about this on past podcasts, Porik is really good in front of media in the sense that he answers the question he wants to answer. He has a slick PR way about him. And, you know, there are times when I can kind of roll with that, but I couldn't watch the whole thing, Matt, because after about four questions in 25 minutes, it just kind of went, I'm not going to get anything of value out of this. He's just going to reiterate the points that he wants to make. He's not going to take any responsibility. To be fair, he's also not going to throw anybody under the bus, right? I think the interesting challenge when you fire a coach and you're the general manager is the questions are all going to be ethereal and difficult to answer in the sense that, and they're questions that we've been talking about for a while and I've written about in Backpass, which is, to what degree did the coach have the players that should have resulted in success for the team, but he screwed up and he didn't set up well? And to what degree does the general manager provide not good enough players that no coach on the planet, you could give Pep Guardiola the Rapids starting 18 and Pep couldn't grind out, you know, results no matter what. Like, it doesn't matter how good a tactician you are if the material's bad. And if the material's bad, to what degree is the general manager responsible, and to what degree is ownership responsible for not investing properly in the team? Those are the questions that we wanted answered, and those are the questions that, in the 25 minutes that I witnessed, the general manager, Porrick Smith, or the president now, Porrick Smith, weaseled his way out of. And I was not the least bit surprised, and I don't think you were. I think you and I were both frustrated. I think we were both vindicated in the sense that folks who've been critical of Rapids Media have said, why don't you guys ask the hard questions? And the answer is, we know exactly what questions they are and are not going to answer. We try and fine-tune that right down the middle. We try to find that perfect pitch that's like in the top corner. The umpire is going to call it a strike, and the batter's not going to be able to swing at it, right? We're trying to hit that spot. We want to ask a question that isn't so spicy that the FO rejects it out of hand, or thinks that we have an axe to grind against them. And we don't want to ask a softball question that makes us look, to compare to this baseball metaphor, that makes us look like fools. And we did the best we could, as we always do, or you guys did the best you could, as you always did. I thought, Matt, your question was fantastic about asking, you know, straight up, like, to what degree is this on the coach, and to what degree is this about the ownership not investing the resources in the team, which Pork didn't answer at all. He just kind of moved right along, and I don't, you know, kind of like mealy-mouthed his way through it. But yeah, it was frustrating, but it was frustrating in a familiar way. It was interesting to see folks on Twitter, which we'll talk about down the road, when we talk about C38. It was interesting to talk to people online who finally saw what we've been seeing, which is, like, sometimes talking to Porrick is hard because he doesn't answer the questions that you ask him.
Last thing that I'll say, Mark, if you didn't hear my 20-minute kind of debrief from this past Wednesday, Thursday, I encourage you to go back and listen to that after having watched the press conference itself, if you haven't already. But Mark, maybe the one last thing that I've kind of heard piecing together, talked to a lot of people in the last week, listeners, increasingly I'm convinced there was not a falling out, but a disconnect, or a Porrick kept using the word deviation between Robin and Porrick. Mark, in an episode of Backpass a few weeks ago, you posited, was there an identity crisis surrounding the Rapids way? Did Robin no longer believe in it? Did he believe in the philosophy but didn't think that he had the players in which to execute it? And should we deviate temporarily in order to stave off bad results? Or did the vision of what Porrick saw in the details in the Rapids way and what Robin saw, did that start to differentiate as well? I haven't really pieced together what that is, but now somewhere, Mark, in the Colorado Rapids multiverse is a version of Robin Fraser who was coaching the players to do a certain thing because Porrick was telling him to. That was necessary in order for them to continue the vision and the idea of the Rapids way, the identity, as I think Porrick was using a replacement word, because TRW has become, you know, a poison phrase to say. It's like saying Voldemort, Rabbi. And so there's a scenario there where Robin is coaching in a way that he disingenuously believes and the players have also kind of given up on or want to see different. So I'm not sure if Robin was doing his version of the Rapids way as opposed to Porrick's version. I'm not sure if he no longer believed in it. And I'm kind of wondering, Mark, piggybacking off of, I looked this up because Joseph Samuelson and I caught up with the wife and had dinner the other night and caught up on Futurama together. And we looked it up, the lineup that Anthony Hudson had at the time of, like, like the question of, were there as many injuries? What was the lineup? What did it look like? And it was either a 4-5-1 or a 5-4-1 that Hudson played in Atlanta for that final game that Hudson was in charge. And those last couple games, Mark, when, as I, Jason Maxwell, others have widely reported, you know, came after Hudson was basically told, like, you've got X number of games to turn it around, and then if you don't, we're going to have to make a big decision regarding your future at the club. And he went ugly 4-4-2, Mark. You know, we saw gradually the shape that Hudson played turned into a diamond in name only, turned into a flat 4-4-2, and turned into not the Rapids way, but, you know, effectively Pablo ball. And did at some point in all of this, did Frazier want to say, we're on the road, let's just go 4-4-2, play hard, run fast? And so I think that falling out showed where the disconnect was. And as I said two shows ago now, we're going to get a number of really good data points as to whether or not this is a bottom group of players, or if a lot of this came down to the repetitive monotony that Robin Frazier clearly had become with the playing staff. And as we'll get to, they've taken ownership in terms of where they are going forward. And then the last thing, Mark, if I can indulge, I've spoken to enough people to where I think I can piece together roughly the timeline of last Tuesday, the day Robin got fired, from an inside baseball standpoint that I think listeners would find interesting. Mark, it is my understanding that Robin was told on Tuesday there was a coaches meeting, and the energy around that was nervous and anxious as well, particularly for Robin. Robin got the call. I have to assume that that was a private conversation between him and Pork, and Pork told him, but I don't know that for sure. Robin told the coaching staff immediately, emotional upheaval, that was going to be an ugly day no matter what, right? I don't know who told the playing staff. I don't know if Robin got to address them. Chris Little was then asked to go meet with Porik. Chris told us that right away when we spoke to him for the better part of 15 minutes. There were four people, Mark, at media training. There were four people at training as members of the media who interviewed Chris Little last Friday, and Chris Little told us that. And then at that point, it was them taking ownership as well. And then there's been enough time that has passed that, you know, I think every single player who wanted to reach out to Robin and have a separate private conversation about his departure from the club and his influence on them individually, that's happened. Pretty much everyone I've spoken to, Mark, was surprised to shocked that it happened. I think maybe in hindsight, the timing made a little bit more sense. And increasingly, there's just a feeling that a bunch of people have let him down. And the way that Chris Little described it was, this happens in football, and Robin's the one who had to pay the sacrifice. But those who are wondering whether or not Robin was told on Monday, it's my understanding he was told on Tuesday that there wasn't necessarily a certainty that it had happened. I'm not entirely sure, Mark. I'm convinced that every single person who's a member of the first team staff, coaches, players, additional support staff, were super surprised or taken back by the decision and the timing of decision. But we move on. Mark, let's briefly touch on the Rapids have a new player, as Porik Smith teased. Took a little bit more than 24 hours for them to officially claim Luis Diaz, former forward winger for Columbus Crew, who was placed on waivers, I think, just a few hours before the Porik press conference, Mark. And then we got news of it later the next day in the afternoon that Luis Diaz would be coming to Colorado. 24 years old, Costa Rican international. His most successful year with Columbus Crew came in 2022. He played 1,540 minutes, 3 goals, 6 assists, only 4 games played, 80 minutes total, Mark, in league play in 2023. I've reached out to enough people at Columbus. They're convinced there wasn't a significant injury issue. He just did not fit what Wilfred Nancy was looking for in a winger. I reached out to Ralph Shadell, Mark, who used to cover the Crew for Massive Report. He has been on the show. Hi, Ralph. And so he said, this is all quoting Ralph Shadell, listeners, don't think he's washed. I think it was more jamming a square peg into a round hole. He's a pretty dynamic player under Caleb Porter, former Crew head coach. Had many memorable moments against Cincinnati that I think will live in the hearts of Crew fans for years to come. Mark, maybe that's an indication that Luis Diaz gets up big for derby matches. We'll see. Ralph continues, I think the change of style doesn't fit what he does. One of my key knocks on his style of play is his first touch fails from time to time, and his finishing is inconsistent at times. Other than that, terrific speed, good human, and will be a good presence in the locker room. He was initially a young DP when he signed Mark. There's no indication, Ralph said there's no indication that he's gotten his green card, so I'd have to go back and look at the math in terms of international roster spot. And with the rule change, Mark, that has since come in, since Luis Diaz has come in, about the U22 signing and other stuff as well, Diaz was a young DP because of the transfer fee coming out of Columbus, but not on his salary. So don't worry, listeners, the Rapids didn't just sign a fourth DP who's a potentially washed winger. Mark, fast, good in transition, sometimes a poor first touch, sometimes inconsistent finisher, has kind of had a falling out with a manager. This guy sounds like a Colorado Rapid already, and he sounds like a 24-year-old version of Jonathan Lewis. Rabbi, your thoughts?
Oh my God, it's so funny that you said that. The last thing you said was pretty much the first thing I was going to say. It's like, yeah, sounds like Jonathan Lewis. Jonathan Lewis's major fault is less for me about faulty first touches and more about decision making in the final third, where he's kind of a shoot first, make a good choice later kind of winger. Do we need more of those guys? I don't know. A big question going forward with the Colorado Rapids is, like, what do they plan to play in? Like, what's the formation going to look like? Because Robin Fraser really liked a 3-4-3 effectively, which meant that there was a left wing and a right wing, and the center player was essential. You could use one of those wide players as they could either be a fullback or they could be a winger, or sometimes it would be four midfielders across that middle section and two strikers, effectively one of them Rafael Navajo and the other one being Rubio. It's interesting, Nancy couldn't figure out a way to use him. I'm not sure that with an interim coach trying to come up with a new lineup with a team full of players who have probably at this point think, well, I haven't been used properly under the last coach. Now's my time to shine in the final, dying moments of the Colorado Rapids 2023 season. I don't know how you work Diaz onto the field. Maybe you just throw him out there and you're like, listen, we've been a hot mess with the guys that we had on the team before now. Let's try a new guy who can, do something different and maybe be a different kind of hot mess. I don't know. It's a really interesting question. I mean, another way of looking at it is this is just a like-for-like replacement for Michael Barrios, that Barrios is gone and we need some more speed, so we put out a pace merchant and see what happens. I guess I'm not... you've convinced me more, Matt, that this is an interesting move. In the couple days we've had to think about it and discuss it, than when it was announced at the time. I remember that it was mentioned at the very end of the press conference with Porrick Smith, that he said, we're going to make an exciting signing in the next 24 hours off of waivers. And I was like, there's nothing interesting in Major League Soccer that comes from waivers. Like, there's nobody, with the exception of the patron saint, Michael Azira, who basically was flotsam and jetsam to the Seattle Sounders. I mean, he is, the exception that proves the rule, though, that, like, if you can get it off of waivers, it's probably not worth it. Maybe I would love to eat my words. There are afterthought players in Major League Soccer who have amounted to something and have done some really good things. It's just not the right timing for the Rapids to be doing anything consequential.
There was some blowback on this, Mark, of like the why didn't the Rapids do more? And I think it bears reminding that the secondary transfer window had closed for several weeks. The big moves that the Rapids made in terms of a midseason pivot were Andrew Gutman, Rafael Navajo, and Sydney Tavares. In order to get then, that limits you, Mark, now at this point before the roster freeze date, which I don't have in front of me, but I assume it hasn't happened yet. At this point now, the only thing the Rapids can really do in terms of adding players is they can sign a homegrown out of the academy, and I think there's some stipulations about them counting as a homegrown and everything. So if you're saying, like, hey, let's sign Adam Beaudry and give him a first team, call up. Okay, that's something that can be discussed and paperwork that can be filled out to make that happen. And a very exciting, actually happy press conference to be had with that. There's, you can sign free agents. So players who've been free agents from the start of the MLS secondary transfer window, you can still sign them as well. And then you're getting guys off waivers. And Mark, like you said, nothing exciting comes from waivers. It's contingent upon another team saying, this guy isn't even worth us having around for the rest of the season at this point. Nothing good outside of Michael Azira comes from that. Lionel Messi is not getting waived by Inter Miami tomorrow for the Rapids to pick up off of the golden scrap heap and everything.
My quick take was just what the Rapids needed to do before the window was sell off any valuable assets that were not nailed down because we weren't making the playoffs. So for me, that was Michael Barrios, Keegan Rosenberry, and Jonathan Lewis. And that's because those are players who had value, who were not young, who were a known quantity, and who were not going to help the Rapids to make the playoffs this year or probably next year. The fact that they sold one of those guys is a pretty good indication that, like, we were lined up, that that was a good thing. Like, I'm sure there are people, there are folks out there in Twitter and on Facebook who basically say, like, the Rapids should have sold Kevin Cabral. And the answer is, for what? A bag of balls and, you know, a promise to stock the soda machine for the next three seasons for free? Like, Kevin Cabral's value has totally cratered, right? Like, we got him for half the price that the Galaxy are paying for him. You can't get him for less than that. So that's the deal. There weren't a lot of moves to make.
And then the last thing I'll say on this, Mark, for listeners that are concerned about this in terms of future roster build, if they think that Diaz is washed, Diaz is in the final year of his contract. So effectively, Mark, you're getting an 8-game rental for a guy to put some film on the tape, either to impress the front office for them to potentially re-sign him, or potentially to convince the new head coach when he goes back and he looks at the film and, you know, reveals, you know, gets a dossier from the film analytics team on what Cole Bassett looked like this season and whether or not they would want to bring back Luis Diaz. So again, yes, it is low reward in terms of what Luis Diaz can bring this season. It's also basically no risk at this point. You know, you're picking up, you know, what I think 40K of his salary for, you know, for a rental in that regard. Diaz has worked his way into training, Mark. He arrived, I think it was, I can't remember if it was late on Tuesday or on Wednesday. He immediately had a medical, or he had a medical then the next day. That went okay for a guy doing a medical at altitude who's only played 80 minutes of league play this season. And then he was in sparingly in training in Friday. There's a member of the coaching staff who told me that they do really like his tape and liked what he did under Caleb Porter with Columbus Crew as well. And it's just a matter of working his way into fitness at this point. And I imagine, Mark, that will be fitness by fire, in that it's not going to be, hey, work your way into training, start becoming a regular training player. Like, it's the, you're on the bench, give us 15 minutes on Saturday, and the next game give us 25, and then give us a half, and then hopefully you're 90 minutes in spurts, depending on how that goes. I want to pivot, Mark, to talk about Chris Little, who I featured the audio on the Burgundy Wave Patreon, and that's free. That's not behind a paywall, listeners, so I'll include a link to that in the show notes if you want to see that. Mark, I was really impressed with what I saw from Chris, having only had maybe two or three formal on-the-record media interactions with him. Extremely gracious, extremely thorough in his responses that he gave media-wise. When I asked him about how he was approaching this, you know, he said that he's bringing new energy. He kind of kept, in terms of detailed approach, Mark, his cards close to the vest. So I am wondering, with what he said about, we need to be a harder team to beat, we need to be better defensively, we conceded too many goals, we need to be able to do the simple things well that made us successful in 2021. That could pivot to me that we might see 4-4-2 bunker and counter at least to start, in order to rebuild the team's tactical approach, or at least rebuild some confidence against New England Revolution. But then he also said the drills that we saw on Friday, listeners, were almost like they were carbon copy of what we had seen in the past. It's not like they were doing anything revolutionary or new. We weren't seeing them come out in a 3-6-1 mark as Marcelo Balboa would shirk at Steve Sampson's tactical nous with the USMNT in 1998. So I could also think, Mark, that it's just simply, hey, I'm a new voice. Robin's gone. There's no more blaming him to the extent that you wanted to blame him. We are now all coaching and playing for our jobs. A new coach is coming in, and you're going to have to prove yourself to him or her. And the coaching staff, Mark, is not thinking about next year. Chris Little hasn't discussed with anyone whether or not he's effectively auditioning for the permanent first team head coaching position. Like, at this point, they're putting all their energy into these eight games. And there was a good response when he spoke to the group last week, saying that they now need to own these next eight games in terms of their approach, in terms of the performance, in terms of the energy, and in terms of the results. So that also makes me wonder, Mark, if there's a, hey, Robin's gone, like, there's nobody else to blame. We're all working, like, we're not going to have a job if we continue to be really crap like this for next year. And so then, Mark, do we see the exact same thing that Robin was trying to do, but then do a bunch of Rapids players come out with knives in their teeth in order to try and get a result? I could see both of those being the starting point on Saturday. I would not be shocked if we saw a formation change off of the comments that we saw, Mark, from Porik's press conference, where he commented about the formation of the shape really needing to effectively be a 4-3-3, what he said about the style of play and the buildup, and then what he said about Kevin Cabral's role. I would not be shocked with a formation change, either a 4-4-2, simplifying things, or a 4-3-3, like, let's just come out with our hair on fire and try and put them under the cosh. And I would not be shocked if we see a noticeable amount of personnel turnover in terms of who's starting as well. And if and when, Rabbi, the it's gone in terms of the Rapids not making the playoffs, like, Ollie LaRoche should get a start, Sebastian Anderson should get minutes, we should see one of the young center backs come in as well. We should get some kind of a data point of what they look like in MLS, not them continuing to clearly overperform the level of MLS Next Pro in 2023. I think that's it for my Chris Little take as well, Mark. Anything that you wanted to say about him getting appointed? I can't remember if you've interviewed him at all.
No, I'm not sure I've ever met him. I have nothing to say about Chris Little. I'm excited that you got to meet him and that you had a good interaction with him. What you said on Twitter about him saying nice things about the media and being appreciative was quite nice. We had this conversation, I think we mentioned it last week, but one of the funny things about Steve Cook was that he was lovely. He was absolutely the nicest, kindest guy when he was the interim for the Rapids after Anthony Hudson was signed, and he totally understood where we were coming from. He answered questions very frankly. I guess this is kind of falling into that tradition, which is like, hey man, I ain't got nothing to hide, and I'm here to try and do a job and solve a problem, and I'll do the best I can, and I'll tell you how it's going. And just being appreciative of, you know, the media still showing up for a team that is really in bad shape. You know, this is the worst season the Rapids have ever had. We've pretty much almost guaranteed that at this point. And so that kind of kindness and respect is nice, but it only goes halfway the other way too, in that we're not going to take it easy on him, but we also kind of know that, like, there's no animosity. We're not angry at him. He's a man who's hired to do a job, and we hope that we kind of want him to succeed, and success is a really weird term for an interim manager, because who knows what the hell it is, you know? Like, if he wins all his games, like, does that get him the job for next year? Like, if he wins half of his games, would that matter? Like, if he wins none of his games, like, what does it matter what he accomplishes? So, you know, it's a very difficult position for him to be in. I think we're all appreciative that he's stepping into the position.
Well said there, Mark. I do want to point out, both with him after the cameras, and then I did have separately with another member of the coaching staff, Mark, you know, they unprompted mentioned my coverage as well, which was really appreciated. Apparently, Chris Little had a really fantastic relationship with Jeremiah Oshan, so that was nice. But, like, I gave them, like, I then responded by saying, you know, if there's anything you think that I think is unfair in terms of my coverage or my approach, if there's something that you want to explain to me. Robin Fraser, Mark, as you know, did not shy away from pushing back on questions that whose premise he disagreed with or that he felt that he didn't understand or were unfair. And now both Chris Little and then another member of the coaching staff told me, like, straight up, I think you've been fair. I think you've been constructive. I think you've gone about it, like, with no agenda or, like, not, you know, you don't have an axe to grind for us as well. And, like, you know, Mark, I don't know if they listen to the podcast, but if they're reading what some of the things that I've said, either, you know, in game recaps or in the other articles that I've written about the club, where, you know, I've taken some pretty big swings and I've called out some people by name, not necessarily those two individuals who gave me that feedback particularly, and they said, like, no, like, I respect where you're coming from and everything, and I think it's great. That's vindication that I'm doing my job and that we can have a functional relationship. So we'll see what happens there. Listeners, we are now going to throw it to the first edition of Know Thy Enemy in a while. Jamie Rook is a New England Revolution beat writer for Last Word on Soccer. I brought him onto staff when I was still managing editor at Last Word SC. He's worked his way into the podcast space as well. I've done a number of podcasts with Jamie. He is based out in London. He's originally a Plymouth Argyle fan as well, and he's brought a wonderful view on MLS from the other side of the pond, and he's done a great job covering the New England Revolution. So as soon as there was a relevant needing a New England perspective, especially given the week the Revs have had, Rabbi, I thought it was only only appropriate that I brought him on. So Jamie, I want to thank you for joining us. I'll drop a link in the show notes to his two most recent really good pieces that I like if you want to get caught up on the Revs' perspective in terms of some of their personnel, listeners. And you can follow Jamie at Rookie, like Rookie of the Year, and then JNR, and then the numbers 1313. But without further ado, here is my Know Thy Enemy segment, which was recorded earlier today with Jamie Rook of Last Word on Sports. And we're back now, holding the high line with Rabbi in Red. I'm joined now by New England Revolution beat writer for Last Word on Soccer and one of my friends through Last Word on Sports Radio, Jamie Rook. Jamie, how are you doing from the other side of the pond, my friend?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. It's definitely been a busy few days and few weeks, even in the Rev space with everything that's going on, and it feels like it's never-ending chaos. But no, it's still interesting to be involved at the very least.
Yes, welcome to for listeners, if you could not tell, Jamie obviously is English. He is a Portsmouth fan. So Jamie, I know we have, or excuse me, not Portsmouth, Plymouth Argyle. We do have a Portsmouth fan in the Rapids fandom space as well, Jamie, but I think most of us are obviously focused on the Premier League. So I don't know that us hearing Plymouth, there will be any obvious negatives. And if we're going back to the origins of the United States, obviously we've got the pilgrimage over from the Plymouth Steps as well. So in the spirit of you covering the New England Revolution for Last Word on Soccer, sorry, not sorry about that whole treason thing some 250 years ago. But Jamie, let's start at the top here with the big news from the New England Revolution side. More stuff continues to trickle out surrounding the Bruce Arena incident. It had been going on for a couple weeks, almost a month now, with there being an investigation going into that. What right after or breaking during the game over the weekend for the Revs, it was announced that Bruce Arena had resigned and had a fairly ominous platitude statement from him about working to be better. And since then, we've gotten more news about Richie Williams from the assistant coaching staff joining and then taking over as interim manager, and the players refusing to train and revolting against him. And then a fairly cringe press conference involving Kurt Anolfo. And that's high given the state of cringe press conferences that we've seen from MLS and from MLS teams. Jamie, what the heck do you make all of this? Do we have any understanding of what happened or what this means for the Rev season?
No, I think, as you say, the bottom line is that no one really knows, A, what's happened, and B, what's going to happen going forward. Because it's one thing if something like this happens in a pretty average season or a bad season, but a lot of people will be quick to forget that the Revs are flying high in the Eastern Conference, second, I believe, now. So there is still a lot to play for. And I think from sitting in on both Richie Williams' press conference yesterday and then that of Kurt Anolfo and Brian Bello today, they have tried to emphasise that message that the season isn't lost and they do still believe they can push forward and compete. But it's just been one mess after another. And then, yeah, when it seemed Richie Williams might be the man to lead the Revs forward post-Bruce Arena, then last night after just yeah, a very brief and uninformational press conference he was then dismissed. I think that was one thing that a lot of Revs media noted from both today and yesterday's press conferences, that a lot was said without really saying anything. I think regularly Richard Williams was asked questions about what Bruce had done and what everyone was feeling about it, and he regularly had to say, just all I can do is refer you to the league and obviously the ongoing investigation. And then today I thought Kurt Anolfo in particular was almost getting a bit tetchy and a bit hot-headed about keeping being asking questions about what is going on. He wanted to obviously try and be somewhat positive and focus on moving forward, but given the lack of information that's been put out, that wasn't really going to fly. And I think some of the Revs media, and then obviously you had some of the bigger players and the likes of The Athletic and ESPN asking questions, were just trying to get anything they could out of it. And it was, yeah, more a case of just deflecting almost and trying to keep out any negativity and try and focus on the season at hand. But then obviously, yeah, with Dave Annenberg and Charlie Joseph both having posted on social media in support of Bruce Arena and everything he'd done for their careers, for those two to then be got rid of, it seems the official statement was parted ways with, but from the press conference earlier, it alluded to the fact that it was probably the fact that they were let go as opposed to walk themselves. And then, yeah, there's just the whole chaos of what the players want. Supposedly the players still don't know what Bruce said. The players didn't find out until after the game on the weekend that he was dismissed. And the whole issue of training yesterday, were they fighting against it and didn't want to participate, or was it generally just a team decision not to participate for the greater good? So I think, yeah, it's a real troubled time for the Revs, and whoever does take forward the club, let's say next season and whatever else, and the powers that be currently, will just be hoping that it doesn't impact the players on the field at the moment, because at the end of it all, they are in a good spot.
Yeah, absolutely, Jamie. I don't know that I wouldn't bet money right now that they were going to catch Cincinnati for top of the East. But once again, Bruce Arena, or if we're including the last couple games with the interim status, that they're still in a position they will most probably make the playoffs, and they have a real good opportunity in order to finally win the first MLS Cup in club history. I should point out, listeners, we're recording this just after 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time on Wednesday, September 13th. So there's an opportunity by the time Mark and I record tonight on Wednesday that there's a few more hours few more business hours on the East Coast for New England to drop another, you know, end of the day press bomb. And potentially you're listening to this on Thursday that has even shifted other stuff that we know. But I think it's very obvious that we can say, Jamie, both from the league perspective and then the higher ups at the club that were a part of this, that whatever happened that initiated the investigation and that led to Bruce deciding to leave the club, that they do not want that information out, and they're not going to give it out willingly. Jamie, I know you're not an expert on legal HR stuff and everything. I have a family member who works on it based in the United States as well. So there's a strong possibility that's a factor going in here. And Jamie, I think we can say now, with the way that some of the players and staff have also responded as well, I think there's a possibility that part of the protest from the playing squad to not want to train was also a reflection of they want answers. So there's a possibility, Jamie, that there are first team players with the Revolution who were not asked to participate in the investigation itself that are as in the dark as we are. And that's incredible with where we are. Jamie, you've done a number of really good interviews and had media interactions with playing staff. You did a really good piece for Last Word on Soccer, a couple months ago, about Kurt Anolfo as well. Can you get into their heads in terms of what they're thinking or how they refocus? To your point, how does this first team refocus and try to get a result against Colorado on Saturday?
Yeah, I'm just really not sure how, as much as they want to portray to the media that they can put to the back of their minds and try and give a positive message to the fans, I'm just not sure how this can't affect things, because whether you're a Bruce Arena fan or not, he clearly had a positive impact on this group and was a good thing when it comes to soccer in New England, having obviously brought home the Supporters' Shield, something which they were that eluded them previously. And then, yeah, I just think in general, Arena, again, yeah, whether you like him or not, he was doing well with the team, and he was able to attract some talented players, and even if they were moved on very quickly, such as Georgi Petrovic, they still were able to make an impact while they're here. So I just think there's definitely a very capable group here, but can they continue on this road they're on, which has them second? There's obviously a lot of people involved now that have been involved with the club for a while, like Yuka Anolfos and Clint PA, I think it's pronounced, as the man taking over, who previously was involved with Revs too and has been around the club for many years. So whilst people do speak highly of him, I just think one thing I'm interested in is how will their tactics look. For example, the question I asked Richie Williams yesterday was, will you carry on with what Bruce has implemented, or do you think now that you're taking over, will you try and make some changes? Obviously, that's now null and void because he is in 24 hours no longer there. But yeah, I do think it'll be a struggle against Colorado, because just no one knows what's going to happen. The players could almost rally and score 3 or 4 and have a great game, or it could just capitulate because there's clear confusion between them both mentally and physically, and just no one really knows where the next steps are. And I do think I would be very surprised if it doesn't affect the on-pitch performances.
Absolutely, Jamie. One thing to point out that we've been discussing in the Colorado media space, Jamie, is whether or not this game needs a name. At the same time on the weekend, we're going to have the local derby for college football. It's known as the Rocky Mountain Showdown, I believe. It's Colorado State University against the CU Buffaloes. Jamie, I don't know how much you pay attention to college football, but there's a CU football is off to a great start under a new head coach, Deion Sanders, and they've got a lot of bravado and a lot of moxie around them as well. So we were thinking that this needs a name. How would you feel about this being the interim cup? And there was even a joke made by someone on Twitter that whichever interim manager wins this should automatically get the permanent job. I don't think that'll happen, but what do you think about calling this the interim cup on Saturday?
Yeah, so first, it's funny that you say that about your football, is that I'm sat here in a Atlanta Falcons jersey and then you're there in a Forest Green shirt, so we've both gone for the opposite cultures. And yeah, I'm not too familiar with college football, but the name Deion Sanders does ring a bell. And then yeah it's one of those where some people do just have to, you've got to make a joke about it, you've got to laugh about it, otherwise it's quite a dire and depressing situation. So I do think it will be fascinating to see if the interim coaches are having an impact on the game and they're able to make an imprint on their teams, or whether it's just going to be go out and express yourself. So I do like that nickname and I would approve of it, definitely.
Okay. I should point out, listeners, Jamie's been having some issues with his camera, so this is a Zoom audio call only, but Deion Sanders should ring a bell for you, Jamie, because he was a member of the Atlanta Falcons from 1989 to 1993, and then he was also, famously, he was a dual sport athlete. He played both gridiron football here in the United States and then baseball as well. I'm not as much of a baseball person. I think he also played for the Atlanta Braves, but I might be wrong about that. I'm sure there's a bigger sports fan probably who will correct me on that if I end up. He did play for the Atlanta Braves. I'm looking at his Wikipedia page now. But Jamie, let's come on to the playing squad. I think if there's one easy parallel to make between the Rapids and New England, despite how their seasons have been different, or the absurdity with which we have an interim manager for the Rapids taking on an interim to an interim in the case of New England, it's their reliance on one player attacking wise, one who's again having a great season, one who's been injury riddled. Carlos Heel has 8 goals and 12 assists, far and away leading the New England Revolution in those statistics. And then Diego Rubio, who was fantastic last season for the Rapids with 26 goal contributions, has been injury riddled throughout this season, and the attack has stagnated. If nothing else, Jamie, given all the chaos that has happened for New England, simply get the ball to Carlos Heel in a good area and support him can be a recipe for success. How important has he been to New England this season? Can he be one reliable, stabilizing factor given all the other chaos that's gone around the club the last day, the last month?
Yeah, I'd have to say, whether he likes it or not, there is so much pressure on Heel's shoulders at the moment, both as a player and as a captain as well, that the fact that, interestingly, yesterday he was supposed to be speaking to the press alongside Richie Williams, and then the very last second after press conference had already been delayed. The media announced that he wouldn't speak. So that was in itself quite an interesting thing, which I feel like a lot of people can read into and analyse whether there's something deeper there. But yeah, he has been very good this season. He's always been good for the Revs, and he is one of those players that can make all the difference. Everything runs through him. It's interesting to see now, particularly from that draw in Minnesota, that he's linking up with his brother, Nacho Hill, assisted Carlos in the 1-1 game. And yeah, it is a lot about Hill, but I do think there are players around him that can make a difference. Thomas Chancellor having recently, come into the team, scored two against Austin. I think he's another player who could well be something for the future and something for the present as well. And I'm interested to watch more and more of him because, yeah, he was very bright against Austin and does look like he can be a dangerous player. Not to make too lazy of a comparison because of the fact they play the same position, but it'll be interesting to see where he maybe compares to someone like Tejan Buchanan when given a bit longer. But despite the fact that there are some very talented players in this team, from Marc-Anthony Kay to Chancellor to DeJuan Jones, although obviously he's assuming, I don't know if he'll be away with the national team or not. I'm trying to work out when he'll be back or not. He may be back. But he is definitely the main man, and has had to maybe dig his teammates out a fair bit this season already. He's doing well in front of goal, and he is definitely clearly a motivating factor to those around him that he can pull them all along for the ride with him.
Jamie, you're an excellent guest because you helped me with that segue right there. Rapids fans are always curious to know about what's going on with their former players. Marc-Anthony Kay, who has been a part of a increasingly interesting trade, but from the Colorado Rapids, 13, maybe 14 months ago to Toronto FC, now finds himself with the New England Revolution. Four games, four starts, and 337 minutes played, one assist. I don't know that there's much revenge going on here, Jamie, because I think Mac was probably happy to get out of a team that ultimately ended up being bad with the Colorado Rapids last year. He's probably even happier to no longer be on the toxic environment that was the Toronto FC this season. And he finds himself once again in the middle of controversy and a team potentially falling off the rails right now. And it should be pointed also, Marc-Anthony Kay will now have never played against the Colorado Rapids with Robin Fraser. But how's Kay been with the New England Revolution, Jamie, in his short time with the club? What could he bring to the midfield against his former team on Saturday?
That was definitely, as you say, a bit of a weird trade, and tracking his career, how many issues have followed him. It was an interesting one. I did think Latif Blessing was someone that did have those moments and did look bright at times, but in general, just although he seemed determined to work hard for Bruce Rooney, it just maybe didn't completely click. And then Kay is another one who, from when he started out at LAFC, was in that midfield with Blessing and Atuesta, was clearly such a capable player and one of the best teams in the league. So I just think whilst he maybe hasn't had the easiest time of it since leaving LA, I do think he's such a capable player. And I think he definitely brings a lot of versatility as well. He's shown he's got the ability to go forward and defend as well. And I think that's always something that the Revs can do with. They've obviously had some various injuries in years gone by. And currently at the moment, particularly with Brandon Bye out at right back, it really is a bit of a calamitous area. We saw Matt Polster, someone even more versatile, play there against Minnesota. And I think Matt Polster is one of my favourite Revs players. I think he's so committed and works so well in that midfield. So it is a loss to not have him in the centre of the park. But Kay can therefore be the one to step up. And I do think, I'm hopeful anyway, he will come good. Obviously, it's so early at the moment, but seeing him along with Ian Harkes in that midfield against Minnesota, I did think whether it worked or not that night, there definitely is a lot to come for them. And they are two players that can contribute going forward, but can also stay back and help the defence when someone like Carlos Hill was able to pull the strings further up the field.
Jamie, there's a phrase we have in American English. I'm not sure if you have it in the UK, of when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. And we might have somewhat of the opposite when it comes to the Rapids attack versus the New England Revolution defense this season. We'll see about Diego Rubio's availability. As I've mentioned earlier, him being so critical to the attack last year, and without him this season, they haven't created a whole lot of chances. And those last three road games that they have that were the end for Robin Fraser, they were just completely impotent when it came to the offense. Sidney Tavares has come in and looked okay in midfield. Rafael Navajo has done good work in possession. He has been completely starved of service as well. And so you juxtapose that with New England, who I would consider to be a good defensive team, but Andrew Farrell's been in and out of the squad. Omar Gonzalez is not the same player that, what, a decade ago was winning MLS Cup with the Los Angeles Galaxy. And then, of course, Jordy Petrovic is now off to Chelsea, and you've got Earl Edwards in as well. Jamie, what does this Revolution defense look like, given how important their now former goalkeeper was? Is this now a weakness that should be a concern for the Revs in terms of seeding in the Eastern Conference?
Yeah, I'd say when you started asking that question, I was like, should it be a concern? Maybe, maybe not. They'll still get over the line into the playoffs. But then when you talk about competing with the very best, such as Cincinnati, as you previously mentioned, I do think it does become a concern, because Matt Turner was so important, and a lot of Revs fans were worried, how are we going to replace him? George Petrovic comes in, and I'd argue, and a lot of others would argue, that he was even better. And then, although Earl Edwards Jr. has been a very strong, solid replacement and stopgap, I just think whether he will make a mistake here or there that does cause an issue. And then, yeah, as mentioned, not having Bai is an issue, maybe more an issue going forward, because as though he is a very good defender, him and Duane Jones were almost most known, particularly under Bruce, for being those flying fullbacks. And then in the middle of the park, you mentioned Omar Gonzalez. And I think when he arrived and played a few games early on, it really wasn't looking good. And he was getting pelters from the fans. And I want to say, as harsh as it is, understandably so, because he was getting subbed on for the last 10 minutes and making regular mistakes. And he was part of a very interesting three arrivals in that offseason, along with Sebastian Leggett and Josie Altidore. Obviously, Altidore didn't particularly work out, and I personally thought Leggett was very capable for the Revs, but quickly got moved on himself. So, yeah, I do think it will be a challenge to see how, as you said, there are some good individual players for Colorado, and then how other teams can do coming up against it as well, because Omar Gonzalez has actually put in some very good performances in the last month or two, and is starting to look like he's gaining some confidence and maybe forming a strong relationship with Dave Romney, who I think is obviously the linchpin of that defence, really, when you've got Bai injured and Andrew Farrell's in and out. Obviously, Henry Kessler's still out. He is becoming a very, very dependable and solid option, and probably one of the better signings of the Bruce Arena era. So, yeah, I do think whilst it can be an issue and maybe an issue here or there, I don't think it's necessarily panic stations or red alert or anything really dramatic.
Last question specifically about the squad, Jamie. I've not been as impressed with Gustavo Bow as I have been with him in the past under New England. You know, can you make sense of what's going on at the center forward position in terms of who will play there and what they'll try to do? Or does it really matter as long as they find ways to get open, given what the Rapids have been like in transition against defense? You know, if they make that run that Timo Pukki did for Minnesota against Colorado, it's just a matter of Carlos Hill finding them and then tapping the ball past Marco Ilić.
So yeah, starting with Bo, it really has been an interesting one. This year has been so on and off for him, with injuries and various things. With one injury, headed back to Argentina for treatment and was out for a few weeks, and now it seems as if he's slowly come back into the fold. I think I saw something earlier that said he is back in it now, but I do think whilst he maybe hasn't been at his best, it is still quite interesting that the Revs do have three very capable options in that position. Giacomo Vrioni has had a very hit and miss start, a few flashes of brilliance, but I would still stand by that from what I've seen of the three of them since Bobby Wood arrived at the club, Wood is definitely my choice to start. I do think he is that hard-working forward, and he is one of those that can allow Carlos Hill to perform his magic. I think when you've got someone like Wood that is able to draw a defender away and make a run, it does just open up that little bit more space for Hill to drive forward and either get a shot off or find a killer pass. So I do think, yeah, Wood has shown to be a good goal scorer in New England, and he's also worked well for the team. So I do think, personally, I've always been on the Bobby Wood train, as they say, trying to back him to be that starting man. But I do think, from what we've seen, more less so than his reputation maybe, is that Frioni may not be that perfect designated player style forward that they were hoping he'd be when he came in. So I do think, in general, it's not the perfect position, but Wood should be, towards his back end of the season, could maybe force his way in and become that starting number nine, facilitating Carlos Hill.
I forgot about Bobby Wood, Jamie, who of course played with Real Salt Lake, and RSL players love scoring against the Colorado Rapids. So we'll see what happens with, I don't know, at this point, like, it could be one of the Minutemen that are interim manager by the time we get to Saturday, with how much things are changing with the New England Revolution. Last question from me, Jamie, absolutely no pressure, no expectations. If you're wrong, we won't troll you about it. Rabbi and I are wrong regularly with our predictions. Do you have a prediction for this game, or is this so uncertain on both ends that you have no idea what's going to happen on Saturday night?
I mean, the safe answer would be for me to say that who knows what's going to happen, anything could happen, but that would be a bit boring. But I think, honest opinion going, obviously it's a road game and the Revs do have so many issues plaguing them off the field, I'm expecting a draw, maybe a high scoring one, with, as you said, Rev's defence maybe isn't as strong as it once was. So I could see it a 2-2 maybe, because I do think this Rev's team are very capable going forward. But maybe the over-reliance on Hill will mean that 3 points is going to turn into 1 point.
We'll see. Listeners, if you like what you heard, you can follow Jamie on Twitter at R-O-O-K-I-E-J-N-R and then the number 13 as well. He is the New England Revolution beat writer for Last Word SC, where obviously I'm covering MLS and the USMNT generally, and then he writes about other stuff, albeit mostly football, on the other side of the pond. And if you have an affinity for Plymouth Argyle, then he's also an Argyle fan, and I'm sure he'd be happy to talk about that and pasties and other stuff as well. Jamie, how are Argyle doing this season? Are you expecting a mid-table finish?
Yeah, done a lot better than expected. 10th at the moment, fresh off a 3-0 pasting with Blackburn, despite a poor performance. So, yeah, I'm positively optimistic that we're very much a mid-table team at the moment.
All right, Jamie, thank you very much for joining us. And then obviously, you know, I'm sure we'll have some banter and a good laugh regardless of what the result is on Saturday. And obviously, good luck finishing your coverage of New England the rest of the season. And come on, Argyle.
Thank you. Likewise. Enjoyed it.
Listeners, we'll be back shortly with me and Rabbi to wrap up the show.
Welcome back, listeners, to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. Matt Pollard here with Rabbi Mark Goodman. Mark, let's take a closer look at the New England Revolution. I guess, Rabbi, let's start chronologically with the events of what's recently happened with the Revs. About a month ago, it was announced that Bruce Arena was stepped away from team activities as he was being investigated for insensitive, inappropriate remarks. That's kind of all we got for multiple weeks. And then in the peak of all news dumps, with it leaking in the middle of New England's game on Saturday and then officially being released post-game late on Saturday night, that Bruce Arena has officially resigned as the head coach of the New England Revolution. There's been a lot of conflicting reports that have since come out about that, Mark. Richie Williams was then appointed as interim manager. The playing staff basically revolted against Richie Williams and refused to train. The way that Kurt Anolfo then described it in one of several super cringe, like, gong show press conferences that the Revs have had since is that Ricky is still with the organization. He was given some time off given the recent changes. And when someone asked whether or not what his future role was going to be with the club, they basically said they don't have an update at this time. The New England Revolution's the MLS Next Pro head coach, Mark, has been appointed interim to the interim manager. Two other assistants have since come out and made public statements supporting Bruce Arena's time time at the club. The New England Revolution have since mutually, quote, parted ways with them, and everybody in the Revs community has basically said, nah, you're firing them because of what they said. This wasn't a mutual parting of ways or anything. There's been conflicting reports about whether or not Bruce Arena had some or all of his coaching staff sign non-disclosure agreements regarding this investigation. There's lots of indications, as we cover with Jamie, that some of the playing staff are as in the dark in this as we are, Mark, in that if they were not asked to be a part of the investigation and then could infer things based on the questions that they were asked and everything, that nothing really happened. There's indications possibly that the reason why MLS and the Revs and no one else individually has said anything is because there's some kind of HR discretion rule that has what come out with this, Mark. Increasingly, this is leading to speculation about, was it something racist? Was it something sexist that he said? Bruce Arena is a 71-year-old man. Mark, we know what the track record of men in their 70s in positions of power and not being asked to change or held accountable can do when they wield that power in such a way as well. To say nothing, Mark, of the fact that every single time Bruce has left a club or a national team, he usually then takes with him all of the nous and personnel management and the intellectual property that basically just leaves a barren wasteland and nobody competent left to go as well. I don't have a lot of confidence in Kurt Arnolfo at this point, Mark. I have no idea who is going to be a fit on the record the head coach for the New England Revolution. This, Mark, if nothing else, things could be worse here at ye old Colorado Rapids, because we know that Chris Little is the interim manager and the players support him, and we generally think he's good at his job, and he didn't get it possibly because of a major HR violation by an old man with white privilege.
Kurt Arnolfo was the manager of the LA Galaxy in 2017. And they were awful that year. They were just absolutely, completely bereft of direction or purpose. And they were a total, complete catastrophe. But he's not the manager at this point. It's a guy named, what was his name? Wee?
There was Richie Williams, who was the initial interim manager, Mark, who the players basically revolted at. I forgot to mention, listeners, there's also been conflicting reports about whether or not some of the coaching staff also walked out of the training that did not happen because of the agreed upon the players choosing to not train out of either rebellion to the way Bruce was treated, or rebellion to Richie Williams, or rebellion to them not being told what's going on. Mark, like, we're talking, this could be single digits number of people between the club and the and the MLS league offices that know what actually happened. And I have to think, Mark, there's some legal reason for why they haven't said what it actually is, or somewhere in there, Mark, there's a decision that the chaos and speculation and all the bad stuff that comes with people not knowing and wanting answers is less bad than people actually knowing, which further begs the question, what the heck did Bruce Arena do?
Well, there's that, yeah. Clint P. is the interim head coach. I'm sorry, P-E-A-Y. I said we, I meant P. It's a bodily function, either way. The other thing that I posted about earlier this week is that, Kalen Kyle, apparently, according to Pablo Maurer at The Athletic, was suspended for 30 days because, the day after Bruce Arena was suspended, she said on air that it was because he'd made a racist remark during a rant in the locker room. She walked that back the next day and said, I don't know that for a fact. I apologize for insinuating what the nature of the suspension was about, and I'm really sorry. And then she didn't appear on TV for 4 weeks in a row, which I find really, all of this is really embarrassing for the Revs.
It's embarrassing for the league, I should say, as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's embarrassing for the Revs because they've decided not to talk about what's going on. It's embarrassing for the league because... My take is this, and I work in a professional organization where, communication and disclosure of missteps on a small level, not like a big level, is part of the job. Like, when you screw something up and it doesn't go well, you have to damage control it the best you can. It's like, you know, day schools do it, synagogues do it, but we do it on a small scale. You know, messaging and conveying information, even when it's going to piss people off or disappoint them, is part of the working world. I think a lot of us who have jobs in this kind of world deal with this, right? Like, if something doesn't go well, you're going to have to figure out a way to break it. My experience is generally you break the news to people and you come clean and you apologize for any inconvenience you've caused or misunderstandings that you've created. You do that quick and you do that on the front foot. You don't hide whatever the hell happened for 2 months, then fire everybody responsible or connected to it, make them sign a non-disclosure agreement, and then hire somebody else after you fire the other guy who came in to replace that guy. Like, it is absolute chaos. The thing that I was about to say, Matt, before we got back off track, is we've been talking about the New England Revolution coming in to play the Colorado Rapids for a very long time, and we haven't talked about the players for the Revolution, how they're going to set up the players for the Colorado Rapids, or how they're going to set up at all. And the reason for that is the narratives of these two teams are two flaming piles of dog poop going head to head inside a flaming dumpster floating down a river, right? This is an absolute disaster of a game. Players are always likely to rise to the challenge, right? You put a professional athlete on a field, they're training, their professionalism, their desire to win takes over. But you can't paper over the cracks of a reality that, like, these are two teams that have nothing to, no direction, that are really in turmoil. The interesting thing is the Colorado Rapids have nothing to play for, but they do have a new manager who they might be able to unify behind. The New England Revolution are almost in the exact opposite situation. They're in second place in the Eastern Conference and are going to make the playoffs and have everything to play for, even if they don't have a coaching leadership set up to play, to set behind. Like, they don't, you know, it's unclear. One team probably is going to come out with an identity but lacks the talent or the desire. The other team is going to come out without any coaching direction but is going to have all the talent and the desire. It's super bizarre, and I can't wait to see this turn into a nil-nil disaster.
Yeah, we do address, I realize, Mark, you have not listened to it, but Jamie and I talk about the situation that New England has personnel-wise. Obviously, we talk about Carlos Hill.
Sure.
8 goals, 12 assists, and he's really key to their attack. And then they, more recently, they've not the same defensive stalwart team that they have been. Henry Kessler has been injured for the better part of the year. Andrew Fell recently has also had an injury. Mark, I think you and I both rate Dave Romney as a journeyman center back, but then I think it's a valid question, Mark, then what are we calling this game? Because there's the interim cup that you have, because you've got the battle of interim managers. And then also, Mark, because of the other injuries at center back, Dave Romney's likely partner in a back four is going to be former LA Galaxy, former Toronto FC center back Omar Gonzalez. Is this the Omar Gonzalez derby, Mark? Does the, you know, is Omar Gonzalez the Rapids communications director? You know, do the Rapids beat over the team that also has Omar Gonzalez? I should point out, listeners, to my knowledge, they're not related. I'm pretty sure Omar has told me that. I'm pretty sure Rapids Omar has told me that. I have not discussed this with Galaxy Revs Omar, to be clear. That would be weird. But so, Mark, there's a question of what does the center back situation look like for New England, to say nothing of the fact that their longtime shot stopper goal saver, Jordy Petrovic, is now on his way to Chelsea for a club record transfer fee, second, third straight year. I can't remember when they sold Matt Turner, but Mark, in recent years under Bruce Arena, the Revs have made record transfer fees out from the club in selling goalkeepers who are excellent when it comes to their expected saves over expected goals. They take away shot, they take away goals based on what you would expect from the XG output versus the actual goals output, or XG after shot on target, to be clear. And so, Mark, I think there's a valid question. When the Rapids are attacking, is this a stoppable force against an increasingly movable object? And from an attacking standpoint for the Revolution, Mark, given everything that we've expressed with our concerns about the Rapids defense and that being broken beyond the new manager bump of, is this just simply a matter of Gustavo Bo or whomever getting a step on Danny Wilson like Timo Pukki did, and no matter what else happens, Carlos Heel's going to thread that ball perfectly, and then somebody's 1v1 with Marco Ilicha. So in that regard, Mark, when we come to, you've already, I think, indicated what you think the game's going to be. For this interim cup, interim bowl, this might be a first for HTHL, Mark. I'm not going to do a prediction because I have no idea what is going to happen in this game. I don't know what version of the Rapids we're going to get. I don't know right. If they've secretly given up on the season. I don't know if they're secretly a terrible team that is just needs a reset of significant roster turnover and a new start and a new manager with a proper offseason. I don't know if we're going to see them come out like a bunch of uncaged gorillas because they're now fighting for their job in front of a home crowd and everything. I don't know what this is going to look like given what we're going to talk about, Mark, with the supporters come the 20th minute of play on Saturday night. And similarly, Mark, do we see a New England Revolution that is in crisis, that is completely are the New England Revolution a house divided, Mark, that therefore cannot stand and competently beat the Colorado Rapids? Or is this a group of players that say, F ownership, F what they did to Bruce and everything, let's go out and win this for ourselves and win this for Bruce, regardless of what the rest of the coaching staff has? The spectrum of what we could see between a unified team fighting for something that they believe in an extremely difficult situation to them completely crumbling under those circumstances, both of those teams could be anywhere on that spectrum. And in that regard, I have no idea what's going to happen. I do not feel educated and informed and prepared enough, Mark, to make a prediction. You could tell me either team's winning 3-0. You could tell me it's the most boring 0-0 draw. You could right. say that it's a 2-2 draw with Diego Rubio going off and Carlos Heel finding Mark Anthony Kay to get his revenge against the Rapids now that Robin Fraser's not here anymore. And I could believe all of those circumstances. I have no idea what's going to happen on Saturday, Mark. I do think I know what's going to happen in the 20th minute, though. Anything else that we want to say about this game, or shall we move on?
Let's move on.
All right, the Revolution will be televised, folks. I just don't know if it's going to be French Revolution bad or 2021 New England Revolution good, or if it's going to be Russian Revolution messy and bad. Okay, Mark, how do we want to tee this up?
You just go right in, just double fist it, just go plowing in, two footed. Knives out.
Okay. Listeners, if you're listening to us after 9:31 a.m. on Thursday, September 14th, you will probably already know this. If you're listening to us earlier on either Wednesday night or early Thursday morning, it is Holding the Highlines understanding that C38 has penned an open letter that they will be releasing right around 9:30 on Thursday. HTHL, Mark, has obtained an early copy of said letter, and then we've also gotten an additional understanding of what Saturday's game could look like, listeners. I will defer you to my recap that I had of the R2 win on Saturday, in which a handful, we'll say a dozen, maybe 20 at the most, C38 members wore black, showed up to support Rapids 2, and then also did some protest chanting. There was "We Want Better," there was "Fire Porik," and then a handful of other ones as well. But let's get to the actual letter itself. I'm not going to read it out, Mark. I want to respect the people or person or entities that made this available to me, but I'll highlight that it, I don't know about you, Mark, you're the Arsenal fan who read the "We Care to You" letter far more attentively than I did. I think the vibes that I'm getting coming off is "We Care to You." There's a lot of, I think, very fair and constructive criticisms of the ownership of KSC and about how that set the club up to fail, but that also the people responsible for the technical and business side of the club have also been delinquent in this. I would agree with that. I've been saying for months now, folks, I think the person most responsible for the failures on the field this season is Porik Smith as well. Porik's name comes up a lot in this letter. And there's, Mark, there was a There were also comments on the infrastructure and the bigger picture issue going on in terms of the stadium that they've addressed, that these measures are long overdue and are taking too long to implement. While there have been some small aesthetic improvements, the building itself remains drab and colorless. And they go on to say, Mark, moreover, future measures seem to be more at the league's behest rather than KSC's own initiative. The stadium is well below the standards for MLS compares unfavorably to minor league stadiums such as the Switchbacks home in Colorado Springs. And there's another, I think, really well said statement here, Mark, that I think some of the conjecture I think is maybe a little incomplete. But so it's very telling that the most recent Forbes valuations estimate the Rapids at $355 million. Yet the expansion fees for new MLS owners is reported to be $500 million. The Rapids are valued less than clubs that don't even exist or just exist in name only. Won't read out the whole thing, listeners. Again, if you're listening to us after 9:30, you can go read it yourself. So listen to us right now if you're listening before, and then wait for the letter to be posted. And then if you're listening to us after, you probably should have paused this by now to go read the letter yourself as well, Mark. There's a couple things here, Rabbi, that I specifically want to push back on. I should say the Forbes valuations that they have are very much estimates and are only based on some conjecture, some reporting which hasn't been confirmed, and then some public knowledge. I don't think that that's necessarily representative of what the league would want for evaluation for any of its clubs. And then also not the valuation that the league would want in terms of approving a potential sale of a team. And again, the reported expansion fees are, you know, vary from team to team that include. So that $500 million, I think, is for St. Louis, and I think it's TBD in terms of what San Diego or what a potential Las Vegas expansion team would pay as well. But the point is, Mark, I think the Forbes article does a really good job of qualitatively comparing MLS teams to each other, and the Rapids regularly are very much in the red in terms of their revenue, are very much below other teams in terms of their spend, both technically and then on the business side, and are regularly valued at or near the bottom in that regard. Forbes, I think, appropriately values that the Rapids are the least valuable asset in terms of the single entity portfolio that is all of the other MLS teams. And then, Mark, there was also a comment in there about the approach to handling media. In there at the end of the second paragraph, general mistreatment of press and bloggers covering the team, among many, many others. I don't know if that statement, Mark, is specifically referring to Burgundy Wave or if it's referring to the Joseph Samuelson incident, which I've addressed multiple times on this podcast and on Twitter and in writing and everything. I would not use the word mistreatment to describe that particular situation. I think the comms team does an excellent job. I think a lot of the issues the Rapids fans and Rapids media have around the club is pointed at people above them in the org chart. I'll put a link in the show notes with a timestamp for those of you who need to refresh your memories on that particular situation. But Mark, we don't want to squash free speech totally here at HTHL. This is an open letter from the fan base. And even listeners, if you listen to this or if people at the club read this and think that there are inaccuracies or if there is hyperbole, Mark, this is an expression of clearly an emotional and a foundation of love for the club, of desire for it to succeed and be better than it has been. I think mainly it's a cry for help towards ownership of, like, acknowledge that you care, that we care, even if you yourself don't care. And it's just an expression of, you know, very clear and I think completely valid frustration. And even if some of the nuanced details are off in terms of how you feel about it, this is what the core fan base thinks. And there's a lot of people, Mark, who are going to read this and say, I completely agree with it. The club could do better to address these, even if the actual detail that saying that the scoreboard is broken and more pixels are broken than fixed, that doesn't negate the fact that the scoreboard is outdated and it needs to be replaced and the club's looking at it, but also it's expensive, it's logistically difficult, and it just further highlights that DSG in many ways could be improved without picking it up and moving it downtown in ways that just further show that the Rapids are behind. They're not asking for Lionel Messi, Mark. I think they're just asking to not be further behind locally, nationally, and internationally, and that's where the Rapids are at, and I think that is a very, very accurate telling. Rabbi, your thoughts?
I mean, the letter is full of things that you and I have been saying for a long time. As semi-neutral observers, but it's from the team's most dedicated fans.
Yes.
A group of people who spend their hard-earned money. They take a chunk of their paycheck every 2 weeks, and they hand it over to the Colorado Rapids LLC reflexively. And don't even question, most years, whether they're going to get a good enough team for their value. Like, the diehardest of the diehard. And we're also down to the point with Seat 38, after like a decade of floundering around and being a fairly terrible team, of like whittling away the core members down to the barest of bare bones, right? Like, you've got to absolutely love the Colorado Rapids to be a member of Seat 38, to sit in 117. And you have to go into each season thinking like, okay, I know what we are. You know, we're not LAFC, we're not Atlanta, we're not Seattle. We're okay with what we are. And they've just seen too much, and they've just suffered too hard, and they are not going to put up with it. I think, you know, the interesting part of this letter, which you alluded to by a statement about something happening in the 20th minute coming up, is 20th minute of the next game, is it is easy to write, and I know this from, again, from life and from work and from politics and from religion, it is easy to write high-minded op-eds, angry letters to the editor, and principled, you know, missives to people in power. It is a lot harder to take comprehensive and meaningful action that will result in something. And it's hard. You have to put in effort, and you have to do something meaningful, and it has to be planned. It has to be sustained. It has to be thoughtful. It has to have cost. I mean, a great example is the writer's strike right now, which, you know, the news in America right now is like guys like Bill Maher and Drew Barrymore are basically saying like, look, you know, we're in favor of the writer's strike, but enough is enough. It's 5 months, and we're going to find a way to, you know, make our television, even though we're going to cross the picket line. And it's like, you have to exact retribution. You have to really take the opposition to task, and you have to do something meaningful that's hurtful. And the interesting thing about that is, if you're going to hurt the other guys, it's probably going to hurt yourself too, right? The only way to affect the Colorado Rapids is to start a boycott, or to reduce the amount of tickets sold, or to spend your own cold, hard cash on things that are going to be hurtful to the team and are going to say, this is unacceptable. Because the last thing I'll say is this, because this could go on forever. You have to not only spend your own money, but you have to exact a price on the Rapids that like hurts you too. You know, you have to be able to say like, we're in really bad shape, and that means that you have to do something. And we're not going to do anything. We're not going to support this team until something significant and material changes about it. And I commend C38 for the letter. I hope that they can create sustained action that will have some sort of result. And I am supportive of whatever they do, because, you know, they're the most diehard fans, and they've suffered more than the rest of us combined.
The last thing that I'll read, Mark, is the final paragraph of the letter. This negligence from ownership must stop. We can no longer be silent like our owners, and it is long past time to say so. We await a response from KSC acknowledging our frustrations. That, Mark, is where I really think this is a we care to you to Arsenal, which obviously is an open letter that the Arsenal fans sent, what, I think this was pre-COVID, Mark, like 2018, 2019 maybe. And then you send that letter that ends in a question mark that then prompts a response. Final sentence, the badge, the players, and the fans deserve better. So this isn't just the open letter that we've seen in the past, Mark, that is just kind of that is strung together last minute and then posted, you know, super late or super early on a weekday or anything. This is clearly a this isn't we care to you. This is acknowledge our frustration, acknowledge that, you know, that you give us an audience, that we've been heard. Like, I think it goes beyond KSC caring. I think clearly there's a lot of quiet parts out loud that Porrick Smith didn't say last week in the press conference that acknowledge what fans have felt and believed for years. And while it might be unfair, Mark, to say that, you know, that to a certain extent, the only thing that we hear from ownership is through somebody at the club, like, that's still going to be curated in terms of certain things that are said, and then how much does Porrick or others put a PR spin as well. And on some level, is Silent Stan and our Josh blank slates then that we can then project whatever we think about them onto them without them providing evidence? To which, of course, this letter then responds, you could do that by giving us an audience. Are we so irrelevant to you as the ginger stepchild of the KSC portfolio that is so irrelevant that you don't even care or think about us, and then therefore you don't even owe us an audience, when the way that you have run the club, you know, almost on autopilot with minimal funding, that's so much there. So I have to think, Mark, that this letter goes out. This letter should get traction. I think we'll get it more than the one from a couple of years ago, which was put out. And that this is then something, regardless of how Porrick or Wayne or others feel about it, it's my understanding, Mark, at least one person at the club's gotten an advanced copy, so they know that this is coming. This is something that then someone in the Rapids FO could take to Matt Hutchins and say, this is what our fan base, this is what our customers think of us, this is where we are falling short. This is something to then take to Josh and Stan and then, you know, like, hear them out. This is what they think. What can you reasonably do more than you have been doing such that they don't feel this way? And, you know, again, I said this on Flyover Footy, Mark, a couple weeks ago when I spoke to Phil Grooms. And we talked about Anthony Markanich, and obviously the guys at Flyover Footy, being St. Louis sports fans, know KSC well, have a very distinct view of them as former St. Louis Rams fans, you know. And I openly said, like, if Josh Kroenke were to come out and KSC were to announce that he's going to be at the final home game, and an hour after the game, Dale's Pub is going to be open, and it's going to be open bar, and whatever you want to come up and say to him, like, he will provide an audience for that. He could do that, and the only extra money they're spending is probably on the booze, not invest another dollar in the first team, not fire Porrick Smith, not invest another dollar in terms of what they were paying, what they're going to pay the new head coach relative to how much Robin was getting paid, and simply showing up and showing that you care in taking time out of your day and acknowledging and providing an audience for fans to voice their frustrations would be a massive step forward for the club. And this frustration, I think, reflects the fact that they feel that they're forgotten from ownership and that ownership doesn't care. And in that regards, the Rapids are irrelevant. We care. Do you? And so I really want to see how KSC responds to this. Do we get a formal public statement from them? Do we get something that's a meeting through maybe some back channels, given how some of that interaction with the supporters group has happened in the past? Do we eventually see at some point in what, the five remaining home games this season, do we see a Joshua Stan or a Matt Hutchinson make an appearance at DSG and then either have some combination of availability with the fan base or availability with the media? I think are all really good questions, and we'll see how that goes. I'm also curious to see, Mark, regardless of what this leads to in terms of action by the front office, how they end up taking, given what we'll talk about in a minute, what else will be happening on Saturday. Mark, I have it on good authority, the final home game of 2018, I think it was, whenever C38 got the Halloween coffin and did like a fake funeral, and then had the TIFO that had the tombstones with the results from the home games that season, whenever it was that happened, there were a lot of people who felt hurt and feel, I don't know if I want to put offended, but like, there were a lot of people in the Rapids FO who were upset at that expression from the supporters group. And so, you know, I would say the response I would say to that is, you know, if you don't want a bunch of C38 members bringing wooden spoons into the stadium on October 21st on decision day, you know, one way to prevent that from happening, Mark, is to put together a better team that does not win the wooden spoon as well. So I'm really curious to see how they handle that. There were two prominent, it was Wayne and Porrick were at the R2 game, Mark, which had the little mini protest of 12, maybe 20 C38 members wearing black that I mentioned earlier, that I wrote about for Burgundy wave. And for the most part, like, there weren't hard feelings or anything like that. There was a concern of what it would look like and whether or not Wayne and Porik showing up would lead to some tension or some unpleasant interactions. Not that it was going to turn into like an incident or certainly not become violent anyway, but they were wondering like, what should we expect from that? And then is that something to where it would make more sense for us to not be there? And my understanding is that after all of that happening, despite Porik being at the top of the concourse and maybe 200, 300 feet away, you had 15 C-38 people in black chanting fire Porik, that for the most part, like, there weren't hurt feelings in that regard. And the other thing I should say, Mark, that was maybe the one thing I forgot to mention when we talked about the press conference, like, I have to wonder, like, how much of Porik's job is now being the front for taking all the criticism for KSE, taking that heat off of Josh or Stan in their absence. And so I wonder, is this kind of stuff, whether it's the difficult questions with the presser, whether it's the open letter, whether it's him meeting with supporters directly, if he's going to get a pat on the back, an attaboy, like, thank you for being the recipient of the punching bag, the proverbial pinata for frustrations that otherwise, if we were to provide an audience, we would receive that directly. And is that then a positive for Porik stability job wise and for him within KSE, rather than it being perceived as him getting dunked on by difficult questions that he avoids, has to weasel out of, or in the case of one of my questions, Mark, flat out refused to answer, which then begs the question what the actual quiet part out loud is, which I think answers to the question whether or not players had filed a grievance regarding with the MLSPA regarding training infrastructure at the club as well. Anything else we want to say about the letter, Mark, or should we talk about what I've heard about what Saturday could look like?
Let's talk about Saturday, man. That's the exciting stuff.
Similar to the R2 game, listeners, fans, not just in C38, are going to be invited to wear black, just like they did as well. And I have strong reason to believe there's going to be a protest, listeners, in the form of a walkout come the 20th minute. There has been discussions internally amongst the fan base and then formally within C38 leadership about what some form of protest could look like, whether it would be a TIFO or something else. And then I think for the first time really all season, like, leadership is on board with the decision about what's going to happen and then doing it in large groups. So there's a significant portion of listeners who are going to show up in the South Stands, 117, and then I can't remember if it's 116 or 118. They're going to be wearing black, and then in the 20th minute, they're going to exit the stadium and go back out and tailgate and maybe go home sometime between that point and then the 90th minute. I have to imagine, Mark, there's a number of fans that are going to go right home and watch CU now that the CU buffs are way better. I suppose the Rapids should try and hire Deion Sanders at this point. Maybe that's the answer. And so I was also told that it's not going to be like a formal requirement for C38. So like, nobody's going to tell anybody else in the South Stands or people who are also frustrated with the club to join them, but like, they are welcome to join them. The Mile High Locos, my understanding, Rabbi, are on board as well. And the drums will likely also stop come the 20th minute. So I am curious, Rabbi, given how the season has been, given it's going to be the start of a really good fall season if you wanted to do something else, given where the team is at, given that Robin's been fired, what it looks like in terms of attendance relative to the average in terms of the C38 section, and then what percentage of the people that are there to start the game actually do walk out. Can you visually tell qualitatively between minute 19 and minute 25 that there's been a mass exodus of people and the section's more empty, or does it just become significantly less loud because the most ardent and passionate supporters are usually the loudest? And then combine that with the drums, combine that with the locos also not being there, what does that look like as well? And so I would also wonder then, Mark, our fans who are listening to us, our fans who hear about whispers of things through C38 social media channels, fans who hear about what's going to happen at the tailgate, do they then join to where there's a noticeable portion of the fan base? You know, normally, Mark, 20 minutes in, there's still people sometimes filing into the Richard. There's still people in and around the concourse getting their beer, getting their Dippin' Dots, whatever, before sitting down in their seats 10, 15 minutes in. Do we see a visual, like, people moving to the exits as well? That's something that I'm really curious to see quantitatively what that looks like as well. And so I think this is, I'm pretty sure, Rabbi, this is unprecedented in terms of this happening and this happening at scale. And Mark, we're not reporting this and talking about it to say that we are agreeing with it. As we've mentioned, there's aspects of the open letter that we disagree with. But I feel like from a reporting standpoint, we're kind of agnostic to it. We're reporting it because we think it's interesting and because we think that it's relevant. But I would support this in that for the fans who are frustrated, this is a constructive way of you going about this. You choosing to not renew your season tickets and then in the feedback form putting in stating that you don't support, that you're frustrated with ownership, you want to hear from ownership, you're frustrated with the front office is constructive. And so I think this is a constructive way of protesting in ways that a TIFO of KSC out or just everybody showing up on the concourse and then looking up at in the direction of the press box where the FO is going to be and giving them the one finger salute. I think this is a constructive way of them expressing their feelings. I think the open letter is doing that. I think what could happen pregame with the tailgate could achieve that. And I think certainly a noticeable walkout of fans in black and the stadium going relatively quiet in the 20th minute could achieve that. And watch, Mark, who knows with the MLS script writers, maybe the Rapids come out like absolute banshees and they're up 2-0 on the New England Revolution and playing like their lives absolutely depend upon it. Like I said, Mark, I do not know what to expect come Saturday and it's going to be chaos.
I mean, to the point that I made about whether C-38 was going to take significant action that would have an impact, this should be significant action. Whether it'll make an impact, I don't know. I think it's really interesting to ask the question of whether this will be covered well by media, and I don't mean Colorado media, whether this will have kind of national soccer implications, because it
does. Extra Time Radio talk about this on Monday, I think, is a good question.
Yes, that's a good question. I think the other kind of national independent outlets, Total Soccer Show, Backheeled, who Joe Lowry's doing really good stuff. It's a 10-minute podcast. I highly recommend. It's kind of the
shouted out HTHL the other day, by the way.
I know, but also, like,
we are racking up these media shout outs, Rabbi.
You know, they're the antithesis of Holding the High Line. Holding the High Line is a long-winded, deep dive, thoughtful podcast that if you don't have a very long commute, may take you all of Monday and Tuesday to listen to the drive to work and back and to work and back. Joe Lowry will hit you up in Backheeled. In your walk to the grocery store to get the gallon of milk that you forgot and back, right? Like, it's a really quick little podcast. But anyways, whether that gets coverage and so on will be really important. I do think that this is an important rite of passage for wooden spoon type level teams. It is funny that for the last couple of years, FC Cincinnati has been the wooden spoon holders, and they were so new that their, you know, supporters group had no reason to freak out and protest deeply. But there have been other supporters groups who have gone on protest for a lot of important things, from everything from abusive coaches to, you know, poor performance by the ownership and front office. Toronto FC, when they were really floundering for the first 10 years in Major League Soccer, they've done some really interesting things. The Metro Stars and NY Red Bulls, who are one of the only, I think they're one of three MLS originals who've never won MLS Cup. They've won Supporters Shield, but they've never won MLS Cup. Those fans, you know, kind of like went, you know, nuts when things went really bad. Famously, you know, there was the press conference, the meetup that they had with the why did you fire Mike Petke? There's a couple of the teams like that who've kind of bottomed out and really reacted, and so I think this follows a really great tradition. I hope that it gets coverage. I hope that it comes together the way it does. I hope that C38 gets turnout, because I think one of the things that's been a challenge for C38 is, like, why would people pay tickets and come to the tailgate and go to sit in 117 to watch the Rapids lose yet another game? Like, they need people to show up who will pay the money to pay for a ticket to go to 117 to walk out in the 20th minute. And that's a pretty big deal and a big ask of a fan base that has been hard put upon this past year. So I hope it has effect. I hope it works. You know, to C38's letter, you know, they noted that they could count on the four hands of Josh and Stan Kroenke, the number of times the two of them have been to the stadium. You know, it is really hard to get those two gentlemen's attention. They own like five or six professional sports franchises, and we're the fifth or sixth most important one, depending on how you rank the Colorado Mammoth. So that's where we're at. Like, you know, it takes radical action to get the attention of the ownership.
All good thoughts there, Rabbi. Like, if the open letter and then whatever, if the protest turns out to be significant, Mark, you know, if we're talking, if at the opening whistle, we're talking 90% full for 117, and then after it, it's under 25, and then there's also like other walkouts either from the south stands or other parts of the stadium as well. Like, the if that doesn't then elicit a response from you know, a response or action from ownership as well, then I think this is only going to ramp up in the home games that follow as well. And if that doesn't lead to any measurable change, then I think that's confirmation of what we've already known, and that will lead to a further disassociation with the fan base. And at other clubs, Mark, around the world that don't have single entity and large billionaire owners, normally I would say, you know, at Carlisle United, whoever the chairman is there, alienate the supporters, particularly a supporters group, at your own peril. I want to believe that C38 is organized enough and that does enough of a good job and then has gotten accurately to the heart of the matter with the open letter and then their actions on Saturday. That resonates something with Josh and Stan Kroenke in ways that maybe things in the past have not clicked with them, but they're not aware of, that then leads to positive change for the club. And if it doesn't, Mark, then, you know, at some point I have to wonder, like, is their collective response of like the, you know, we're just holding on to this asset until we can sell it for a bunch of money once MLS decides that we're full, and just be happy that you have a club regardless of how bad it is.
Just be happy you have a club is the brutal, you know, kind of rock bottom below the level of wooden spoon that we really don't want to think about, but they could make us think about.
Mark, to quote Kurt Analfo, why don't we get out of here and, quote, stop talking about all the baloney. I have to edit this podcast. I've got to set up some stuff to be stubbed and published at 9:31 tomorrow morning, and I've got to watch Welcome to Wrexham because it's going to be lit. And Mark, I'm really curious to see. I don't know what's going to happen. No spoilers, Rabbi. I don't know if they're gonna play Sheffield United in the FA Cup or if they're going to get promoted. We got to wait and see, right? Who knows? This is Hollywood drama, not an actual sporting event that happened months ago. Listeners, follow us collectively on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at @LWSMattPollard, and at @Rapids96podcast. Check out all of our Rapids-related musings at our Substack, holdingthehighline.substack.com, and at burgundywave.com, where you can see the various content that I have plugged throughout tonight's show. Get at us with questions on the Twitter X machine using the hashtag AskHTHL, or in long form emailing us at rapids96podcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for sticking with us, you know, beyond this, you know, almost hour and 40 minute edition of the podcast. Listeners, we'll see you next week.